Welcome, everyone, to this second event in our 2021 speaker series, Taking the Digital Wealth Estate to Court. My name is Judith Rauhofer, and I am DFF's legal officer. With me are my colleagues, Jonathan McCulley, DFF's legal advisor, and our events officer, Jihan Jadran. Together, we'll work behind the scenes today to ensure that this webinar goes smoothly and is not plagued by any technical difficulties. To give you all a bit of background to the series itself, over the past 2 years, the protection and promotion of human rights in the context of the digital welfare state has been a major focus of DFF's work. We are particularly concerned that the increased use of digital technologies and automated decision-making systems in social security and welfare contexts violates human rights and exacerbates the over-policing and penalizing and exclusion of marginalizing communities and those who are in need of vital support. We've already discussed these issues at a number of our workshops, like, for instance, our litigating algorithm workshop in 2019. We've also held a number of one-on-one and group consultations with a range of organizations working on the topic. And based on these consultations, we've already produced a strategic document to inspire conversations on how strategic litigation can be used as part of a broader strategy to address the harms of the digital welfare state. You can find that strategic document and more information about our activities in this area on the DFF website. And my colleague Jonathan is also going to share the links in the chat. You will be able to see them there. We also continue to engage with a range of other organizations on this topic, including racial, social, and economic justice organizations as part of our ongoing Digital Rights for All project. Our objective here is to provide a space to the people most affected by harmful use of technologies, but who are often not the ones leading the advocacy, policy, or strategic litigation work. And we do this essentially to create a space that allows them to develop their own agenda. That's a process that our colleague Laurence Meyer, who leads on that project, has just summarized in a really interesting blog that I can actually just recommend to everybody as Nothing About Us Without Us. This year's speaker series seeks to complement that work by exploring a range of cases from different jurisdictions and relating to a range of different welfare state issues to show how strategic litigation can be used by and in collaboration with these communities to protect their digital and human rights. The topic of today's event is profiling algorithms safeguarding the unemployed in Poland, and it looks at an automated decision-making system that was introduced by the Polish Ministry of Labor and Social Policy in 2014, which profiled unemployed individuals based on their personal characteristics. The tool was then used to determine what kind of support those individuals would receive from the local labor offices. The system was successfully challenged by Polish digital rights NGO Panopticon, with the result that in 2008, Poland's Constitutional Court ruled that the ministry's use of this profiling tool violated the Polish constitution. With us today are Dr. Jędrzej Niklas, a research associate at Cardiff University's School of Journalism, Media and Culture, and the Data Justice Lab, and Dr. Cengiz Baskanmas, who is a postdoc at the Free University in Berlin and also a research associate at the Max Planck Institute for Social Anthropology, also in Berlin. Before rejoining academia, Jędrzej was a legal and policy specialist at Panopticon, where he worked on policies relating to data protection, automated decision-making, surveillance of vulnerable groups, and so on. And that's, of course, also how he became involved in the case that we're going to hear about today. He now works with Lina Dencik at the Data Justice Project in Cardiff, where he explores the role of emerging digital technologies in the operations of state and public institutions and their social justice implications. He holds a PhD in international public law from the University of Warsaw and is the author of several journal articles and reports related to data-driven technologies, human rights, and political theory. Cengiz Baskanmas is currently the operational manager of the research project Open Access in the Legal Sciences at the Free University of Berlin and also an associate of the Max Planck Institute for Social Anthropology. His research is primarily concerned with critical race theory, diversity and intersectionality, and digitalization. And he's the author of a book, Law and Racism, The Prohibition of Discrimination on the Basis of Race, in which he explores human rights protections against racial and ethnic discrimination. He is a co-founder of Critical Race Theory Europe, which is playing a key role in the development of a critical race theory network in the European region. And together with Kimberly Crenshaw, he organized the first symposium on critical race theory in Europe and Germany at the Humboldt University in Berlin in 2012. I will shortly be handing over to Cengiz as the moderator of this event, and he and Jedrek will then spend about 30 minutes to talk about the background of the case and the lessons we can learn from it. And while they are talking, I would like to encourage all of our listeners to use the Q&A function to ask questions that you may have on the case. There is a Q&A tab that can be found at the bottom of the right of the screen to the right. We have about 20 minutes towards the end of the webinar to allow Jedrek to answer as many of your questions as possible. So please do not wait necessarily until, you know, this is all over. Capture the question when you think of it and just add it to the Q&A. And we're basically just going to add it to the list. And on that note, and without further ado, Cengiz, Jedrek, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much, Judith. Thank you for this nice conversation. I am so delighted to have this conversation with my colleague Jedrek, and I am totally inspired already. While I was actually preparing my my function as moderation here, Jedrek, I would like to start with a very basic question. Would you like to tell us just like the basic information, the context about the case? So what's the origin story of this case? How did it come about and who was much more involved? And as you have answered this, I will maybe also continue with some other questions I have for you today, please.
Perfect. Let's start with the origin story. And thank you, DFF, for organizing this. It's a real pleasure to talk about this case that I think is also not as well recognized as I think it should be. So the origin story and the bigger context is that in 2013, Polish Minister of Labor and Social Security, they start thinking about reforming the system of public employment system. This is like the system welfare, part of welfare administration that is providing help and assistance to people who are in the crisis of unemployment. You know, this is like a big welfare institution in Poland. This is like almost 360 local job centers all over the country. They are providing, they have a big budget. They are providing a lot of assistance. It's a complex and although big and quite well-funded, it's still very dysfunctional. And at some point, because also the resources, as in all welfare systems, are quite, you know, are quite scarce, the government is deciding like, well, we need to divide those resources in a better way, and we need to like have some kind of tools to do it. And that's why we are trying to introduce this profiling mechanisms. That, on the other hand, it's also being used in many different countries. We have also examples in Austria, in Portugal, in Spain. Oh, I think it's all over the Europe. And for a long time, it was also a thing that was advocated, for example, by OECD and European Union. And in countries like Poland, and I think also Hungary, you know, it's also like a Western, Eastern game and so thinking how we can jump into this modernization train with being more as West. So the reform is coming. They are trying to make a new law that is introducing this profiling. Basically, it is dividing profiling of unemployed people into three categories based on like 25 data different data points. Each data point is assigned with a particular score from 1 to 12. It's gender, education, but also things like how far do you live from the bigger city? How long have you been unemployed? Those kind of information. And each is assigned to particular points.
You know, Jedrek, I was wondering whether, as a critical race scholar, whether race was one of the factors, since one of the most prominent profilings we know is racial profiling, right? But what does it tell us if race is missing here? Does it mean that race is, in the Polish context, not relevant, or does it mean that there was a blind spot?
It's a very good question, and I will just give me a second because
You want to come back to this later?
I will go to this question in just a second because I want to just give you a context where we started working on this when I was working at Panoptica.
Great.
Because our organization was mostly focused on legislation and providing legal opinion to draft bills. And this is how we start looking at this provision. And there were really interesting information and really interesting process going on. And one of the biggest by advocacy point was that profiling should be not based on sensitive data. And that's why, for example, like race, but also disability. For example, disability at some point it was erased from the idea to be included in the profiling system. Race was never a thing. I think they would not dare to add it. And I think this is a kind of also a very strange European approach to race, or even in this context, I think ethnicity. I heard discussions because that was a thing in Polish context that maybe not a race, but ethnicity, because like there at that time, there was also a big group of Chechenian migrants in Poland. And that was, most of them they were unemployed. And it was an information for job centers probably to process. But at the end, in this profiling mechanism, it was not included. But I think it's also a very interesting idea. Also, when you compare this to the other questions, what is happening also in Eastern Europe. And
exactly, Europe. Absolutely.
But going back maybe also to, so we started doing this kind of advocacy around this profiling mechanism, mostly based on the argument of transparency that we saw that, yeah, like the previous system of providing assistance to unemployed people, it was based on the very simple categories that were, enlisted in the law. Like if you were a single mother, you were allowed to have this particular kind of assistant. If you were a person that is 50 plus, you were allowed to have specific kind of assistance. But now they wanted to create more sophisticated mechanism to assess people, what kind of categories you are. And while they were saying it, this more individualized.
Jedrek, just a technical issue. Would you be so nice and hold your mic a little microphone bit closer to your...
Yeah.
Exactly. Perfect. Thank you.
Yeah, I know. The microphone is not perfect, but I hope you can still...
But that's an excellent sound right now.
Yeah, perfect. So so the argument was that from the side of the government that they wanted to introduce more individualized system to provide this help to unemployed. But at the end, they were creating a very, I would say, rough categorization and dividing people into three big categories. The first one was that people like higher education, they know languages. So maybe they are now unemployed, but they don't need our help, which makes some sense from the perspective of the institution that do not have enough money to provide assistance to everybody. And by assistance, I mean not welfare benefits, but some sort of training, state-subsidized internship, something like that, some additional things that help you to get out from being unemployed. The second category, the biggest category, where the people that, well, they have some problems, but we can help them and we can fix their problems. And the third category was the people, like, I would say, helpless. So they are, like, for example, single moms that are living in the smaller villages. So maybe we should not direct assistance to them. Maybe that's the social security branch of welfare state, but not us. But, you know, it sounds pretty rational at the beginning, but at the end when we were... and this is later stage of this case. And I prepared a diagram that just shows also our work and how this case evolved over many years of litigating, advocating, etc. So at the beginning, I'm still talking about the legislative process because the system. But where we were trying to advocate, it was still a draft bill, but it came into force in 2014 as a part of this bigger reform. And this is how we were when things get really interesting and how the whole big thing in our organization back then started. So first of all, like the first interactions we had with the Ministry of Labor was also that we wanted to get the questions that were asked during the profiling moment, I would say, because the profiling was that, you know, if you are unemployed, you're going to the job center and you're being asked many different questions. And based on those questions, you're being, you know, assessed, I would say.
Yeah. And just a quick question, Edric. We are having questions from attendees and, you know, I was also not quite sure about it. I want to make sure that I overheard something. To what extent was education a factor in the profiling? And was it much more a determining factor at all in the system? Would you like to elaborate more on that?
Yeah, it was absolutely a factor in that. And definitely, like, if you had better education, you received different points than if you have lower education. But it completely makes sense, you know, like, if you have...
Does education...
It's a degree, I would say.
Come close to class as a category?
I would say, yes. On the other hand, Polish higher education system is quite, I would say, strange because, and it is also a case for most Eastern European countries, we have a very high level of people with higher education degrees, like really high, much higher than, for example, many Western countries, but it is also bad education, I would say. So it's not... like the higher degree does not always say it about your class. The kind of university you're going says much more. So it's rather formal. But on the other hand, also like gender was also element of this assessment, which is quite tricky. I remember it was just one, like women, men were received, like they received 0 points. Women received 1 point. Which is not a big difference in the whole scheme of assessing, but at that point, it gave some sort of indication that women can end up more easily in the third category that is not receiving anything from the job centers, and especially if it was combined with being a single mother or a person like that is. That is giving some sort of assistance to elderly parents, for example. That was a thing. So it was a gender issue at the end.
Just to wrap up a little bit. Yeah. Understanding that there is this profiling momentum where you have three profiles and people who are the first profile were... I mean, the most successful profile or the most
second profile. It depends.
Exactly. But what was the legal argument about the ombudsman? The Polish ombudsman made, I think, like a double track argument. Correct? If I'm not, if I didn't misread the argument. So on the one hand, they're actually attacking the profiling as being unconstitutional. And on the other hand, that the delegation of powers would be actually unconstitutional. Can you elaborate more on that and maybe also tell us what the court actually found?
Yeah, I will just give one small map of also what we have done in this case, because on some point we were asking, for example, using freedom of information requests, the question that we're asked during profiling, that was one case, and we received them from the Ministry of Labor. The second FOIA request was about the scores that were assigned to particular answers during the profiling moment, let's say, let's go like that. And then that was something that we haven't received at the beginning, but we went to the court. That was in 2015, I guess, and the ruling was in 2016. So it was one first litigation, and that was the argument that Panopticon and other activists were saying, and this was related to transparency of this whole mechanism. But then you have to understand that in Polish system, NGOs cannot easily go to the constitutional court. But who can is the Human Rights Commissioner or the Ombudsman. And we twice approach Ombudsman to, first of all, provide some arguments to them. And they are, at least on our side, the arguments were really, it was a lot of that, I would say. The first one was about transparency of the system. The second was very formal, I would say, because in Polish legal system, there are two kinds of laws or bills. The first one are bills that are accepted by the parliament.
Yes. So
they are called like the bills, like the proper bills. And the second are regulations that are issued by the ministries and government. So this is like an executive, like I would say.
Exactly.
And most of those things are just to provide some, you know, specificity or technical aspects that are specifying the legal bill. And in this case, that was the most important thing was at the end, I would say then that this is what the Constitutional Court said, that the things that are in the executive act that was issued by the government, the Ministry of Labor, should be in the bill, because in the Polish Constitution, any kind of provisions that are limiting right to data protection privacy should be in the bill that is accepted by the parliament and not by the regulation. And that was one of the most fundamental arguments. It is very formal, I would say, and there is nothing
incident
about that. But that was something that we could work with. That was the second argument. But other arguments also were related to the discrimination, because at the end we received those scores and we saw that women are assessed different than men, first.
Mm-hmm.
And the fourth argument was related that, well, when there is this kind of moment of automatic decision making, the unemployed people cannot, they do not have any kind of way to request a new decision that is not made by the machine or the computer at the end. Because this was still, you know, this is a very simple from the technological point of view system, but it was still done by the computer and the IT system that was used by the Ministry of Labor. So we approaching those arguments with those arguments, we went to Human Rights Commissioner twice, and at the end in 2016, I guess he used those two arguments: the formal one, the difference between the bill and the regulation, executive regulation, and the lack of this possibility to challenge the decision by the unemployed, the decision that has been made by the computer. And that was the base of the of his statement to the Constitutional Tribunal that started this whole process that took 2 years to finish. Constitutional Tribunal for 2 years was debating or proceeding, I would say. Sorry.
Please. And maybe on this occasion, I would appreciate if you exactly.
Yeah. Sorry, I'm using my hands a lot, and
yeah, I know. Sorry for yeah,
No. Please do. And
yeah.
So and just yeah. Sorry.
Okay. Well, can you also like tell us what the litigation has achieved so far, and so where are we today? And when you look back to what happened, and I mean, because the tribunal, the Constitutional Tribunal, is partially struck down. As far as I am not misinformed, the new regulation abandoned the profiling, although the constitutional tribunal did not actually find that unconstitutional. I think that's a very nice side effect. Because in the beginning, when I was reading, by the way, is there an English translation of the court decision?
I think there is a summary that I'm not sure if we can share it on chat.
Maybe we can share it later. Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Share it on later. It is exactly what you said, because the Constitutional Tribunal just said that, like, based on those two arguments, first of all, it said that there is nothing unconstitutional in this machine, in those machines making those decisions, because in the Polish administrative law, you still can challenge this kind of decision. Maybe not decision made by a machine, but at the end, the decision of, for example, of you not receiving some sort of assistance. That's
exactly. And profiling was just one of the factors, right? And that's, it was not determining. right?
It was not determining, however.
Exactly, of course.
It is very interesting because also at some point we received, we did like a lot as a Panopticon. We did a big, I would say, a research that took a couple of months to understand how the system works in practice. And what we saw in data was that, well, it was not determining at the end. The machines were not determined, but well, they did actually, and nobody was challenging on the side of the street work, like the street level bureaucrats. They were not challenging what the computer was saying, at least at the beginning. So the Constitutional Court said that, well, that part is not, like, you can still challenge this in some way, but from the formal perspective, so this difference between the law, like the bill and the regulation, that's something. So it is a very conservative decision, I would say. There is nothing precedent about that. But at the end, and it is also a political, it is also a thing that I think it's very interesting that also showed that those litigations are not always like the silver bullets. There are more things happening. And for example, here, what was absolutely also important was that at some point, we have this institution that is called Supreme Audit Office. That it's a very strong institution in Polish system and in many Eastern European countries. They did an inspection of this provider mechanism, and it said that, well, it is not working. It's bad, and it's like not effective in providing the assistance that Ministry of Labor should provide. So this audit, the Constitutional Tribunal decision, like they basically create a momentum to change the law, and the Ministry of Labor was saying, "Well, so maybe after those years that we have been trying to use it, we will change it completely and we will abandon the system because it's not working from many different perspectives and using many different arguments." From transparency, effectiveness, also the formal aspects that was raised by the Constitutional Court. So there are many different arguments that help to build this momentum to change the law. So it is never it was never a litigation, but it of course helped a lot. There's also not the most covered issue in the Polish press, but it was still also very interesting for many different journalists, and it was something very new in the. In the Polish context of administration and receiving welfare, etc.
I see. Jędrek, if you look back today, what is your conclusion? Are you happy with the outcome of the case? And are there some side effects that you're not really happy with? And so what work is still to be done by court and governments? And so what's your expertise on that?
Absolutely. I think it's...
Did you face some ethical issues as well?
Yeah, that's a very good question. I think that's... because the outcomes of the... of this mechanism, and I think I forgot also about one important thing, especially in the work that we have been doing at Panopticon, that it was the first time that we have been receiving so many letters, emails from people telling their stories. Because when profiling mechanism was in force, there was a lot of drama about that. Like drama, I mean like the proper dramatic. Events for many people, like they were not receiving the assistance they were expected to receive. And, when you're a single mom or you're like, for example, this issue with the subsidized internship at companies, that was something that helped a lot of people. And suddenly they are not allowed to get it. So we are receiving those letters. We are receiving telephones. We are receiving emails. And that is the first time as a digital rights organization that we are having those kind of, I would say, victims. And that's a very important element of this whole job. And also that gave me personally also a lot of strength, to do it for so many years. I was very emotional about that at this time. But what is, I think, very interesting in the sense that is the strange outcome of this, is that after so many years, and especially also when we... on our webpage, we published the scores, we published the questions. So for many people, it was also a resource that they could use when they are going to the job centers. And at the end, also game a system a little bit. So That's one, the first of ethical question I would say for any kind of digital organization, that this, you know, showing, let's say for the terms of this conversation, an algorithm, but of course this is not an algorithm or code, it's rather how to use the system in your own games at some point.
So people, just a quick question there.
Yeah.
So to understand, like, what are the very specific implications for people with respect to their score? So how did this work in everyday in the practical? Can you give a couple of examples maybe?
So basically when, for example, so you're unemployed and you're being profiled as this third profile, for example. So before
the abandoned, can we say the abandoned?
Abandoned, yeah. So yeah. Or the trash people, I would say, even in more harsh language. But when you are this kind of in this group, before that, you can apply for most of the things that you can get from the job center. Courses, trainings, and the most important thing, the subsidized internship at the company. So the state is paying for 6 months of your salary in the company, and after that you will get a job because you will stay at the company. The company is getting something. Everybody basically is happy about that. And that was a crucial element. And when you're landing in the third category, you are not receiving it. You are not even allowed to apply for that.
I see. That's very practical. That's very specific. People feel that.
Yeah, that's very specific. And also, you know, it was also interesting for us at this moment when we were discovering what is happening in practice. You know, we know nothing about welfare state mechanism and system. And we need to have this cooperation, for example, with sociologists and experts in the welfare from early beginning to understand what is happening, because there's a lot of nitty-gritty about receiving this kind of assistance, receiving this kind of benefit. And it was like a lot of knowledge you have to get before you even start any kind of litigation and advocacy.
That's empirical research.
That was completely an empirical research. But going back to the outcomes at the end of, let's say, like after the Constitutional Court in 2018 is saying, well, it's unconstitutional in 19, sorry. So we are receiving... I saw that we are receiving mails that some people are happy because it was the whole profiling system makes no sense for many of the people. But some of them are saying, what have you done? Because, you know, the Polish system of providing assistance to unemployed have since 1990 has changed 92 times. It's an unstable system. So when you have something and when you can use it for your own gains also, you prioritize stability over, I would say, procedural fairness to some extent, from the perspective, of course, of digital or human rights advocates that see it as a priority. And I think there is a lot of things going on here and a lot of tensions. I'm not saying that there is always tension between, for example, stability of the welfare system and the procedural fairness or fighting for procedural fairness, but it can be. And that was something that when I realized, okay, so this is when, you know, when we are litigating, when we are advocating in this context of digital welfare issues, we are messing with people's lives. We need to be absolutely aware of that. And most of the organizations, I feel, in the field of digital rights, they have not enough knowledge about those systems. It is not like, you know, it was a very comfortable situation when we were like litigating against police and secret service. It is completely David versus Goliath, very nice story to sell. But when you are going and entering to the welfare systems, this is something much more complex and complicated. And this is absolutely not David versus Goliath story. However, I would like to sell it as one.
Yes.
This is absolutely about messing people's lives to some extent.
So what's your general impression working with the communities? Are you still in touch with the communities you worked with, and how was at that moment working with the communities? Did you face some challenges?
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, first of all, there is no such thing as a community of people, of unemployed people. Unemployed people, this is like a very diverse group. However, we when I was then working at Panopticon, we reached the organizations that are fighting for people in the crisis of poverty, for example, or the crisis of homeless, because they are also, these are also like one of the most affected groups in the unemployment system as well. And we were trying to have this conversation. Also, during our the research project, we have been doing a lot of interviews with unemployed people. So we were trying to get as much knowledge about their experience as it is possible. So that was the most important. But I would say that there was still lack of some sort of, you know, community. It was rather us organization that is having some sort of resources to do a lot of litigation and advocacy, and a group of citizens that may benefit from it. The important element that helped us a lot, that was the few sociologists, especially Karolina Sztandar-Sztanderska, who is now also doing big project on profiling and trying to understand what happened over those years, that they help us a lot to understand the whole system. And that was absolutely crucial. And I would suggest that everybody, if anybody would like to do any kind of advocacy or any kind of thing related to digital welfare state, you need to have support from this side. If you only have knowledge about data protection, sorry, no, this is not enough to enter this theme and issue and address it from somehow.
I have a couple of more questions to you, Jedrek, but also to the audience. Please feel free to start to ask your questions in the Q&A bar. You will find the Q&A bar on the bottom of your screen. And I will pick up your questions and address that to Jedrek. Jedrek, you know what I find very interesting is that you actually went to the Constitutional Court that is today very disputed, the Polish Constitutional Tribunal. As we might know, last week, the Constitutional Tribunal declared EU law as non-compatible with some provisions of the Polish Constitution. So how do you feel about that? So you went to the Polish Constitution to find some help, and by doing that, actually, you're legitimizing the Constitutional Court. At the same time, people are also, the voices of people who are saying that this is a almost illegitimate court. I think there is a tension there. How do you feel as a Polish legal activist about that?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's, well,
and how do you see the future from here?
Oh, that's a very tricky thing. But let me explain also a little bit, you know, the whole mess of the court, it didn't start just like last week. It's a thing, it is a drama that is happening since 2016 when the new government, the conservative government, took power, and they start also messing with the constitutional court's judges nomination. And that was the whole thing that...
Yes, definitely.
This problem. And now basically, you know, as I was saying, that we challenge this law indirectly, because through the Human Rights Commissioner office, to the Constitutional Court. And now what I know from the Human Rights Commissioner office is that, well, they are not challenging, they are not addressing bills in the Constitutional Court because they see it illegitimate. So I think now this way of challenging law in Poland does not exist. Like, this is something, and this is, you know, big politics that is happening around us. And it's not only Poland, I guess. It is also Hungary, and probably maybe, and hopefully not other countries in the future. But who knows? In those different times, and difficult, and different, and strange times, you can still think about European Court of Human Rights. But you know, like, it's nice to have a precedent, but it will not change the law, especially when you have a government that is not so strict on thinking about human rights treaties and other things. So it is a big thing what to do now. I don't know, like, I think the activists that are now working still probably at Panopticon, but also Helsinki Foundation for Human Rights, would say that it's not like helpless completely, but it's definitely limited the ways how you can challenge the things. And you need to go more creative, probably more grassroots campaigns and so those kind of activities. And,
exactly. Yeah. You know, exactly, Idrik. I would also add that, and sometimes even losing a case might have helped advance the case more than actually winning it. It all depends how actually you constitute or you go forward with strategic litigation. Winning is always not winning at the end. Sometimes you can lose a case, but you can achieve maybe your goal much more with a loss. So even to come back to the question of to what extent it from now on in the future, it would be legitimate to address the questions to the Constitutional Tribunal, maybe other legal avenues should be explored within the national legal order, but also maybe internationally and European-wide.
Yeah, probably. And I also want this is also an interesting element of this for this case that the conservative government that took power in 2016, it was against the profiling mechanism from the beginning, and the profiling mechanism was introduced by the Liberal government that was before. So you know, there's also a lot of
what was the reasoning? Why exactly were they against it?
Well, they were not saying directly that they are against it, but the new government, which is conservative and rather nationalistic, it is still a government that is giving more welfare spending, basically. It introduced a lot of new social security programs. And the previous government, while it was liberal in this, I would say procedural aspect, it was still a neoliberal government that was cutting welfare. So it's also very strange, really different dynamics and the big politics happening around that.
You know what? This really reminds me at the Agenda 2020 in Germany, where Schröder was actually the one who introduced like the so-called hard sphere. And that was a real breach in the so far social benefit system. And now actually they want to undo it in some way because they see that the consequences of that for people is all but good.
Yeah, and I think, with this issue, what I just said, and also what you just described with this politics also around the welfare state, I think that's also another question for digital rights activists, because they were not, for a very long time, they were not even thinking what is their attitude to the welfare system. How do they? Because, digital rights organizations, or at least from my experience, we have been kind of this kind of anarchistic, more, individualistic, privacy, individual privacy things. But now if you, for example, would like to go into this kind of direction of thinking about digital welfare state, well, you need to think also about completely different things. It's, for example, welfare and also this kind of austerity thing that were happening in this context. It's a very big political question. And I think the community around digital rights have not been thinking about this yet. I think that's a very good moment to think about those things. But, there is a lot of issues that need to be digested, I would say, and they have not been for a very long time.
This also sounds like, Idrik, to me that, like, in the beginning when the liberal state was there and the constitution was enacted in Germany, freedom was much more important than equality. And today, in the legal doctrine, equality, it is unthinkable to not to include equality, at least the progressive legal doctrine is so far. So it sounds like also digital rights movements were actually much more actually concerned with freedoms than actually with structural inequality. And this case shows very well that also digital freedom or the digital rights activist should definitely keep an eye on structural inequalities that actually are part of the unequal freedoms, right?
Yeah, and I think that we are slowly starting going to this direction. We can see many work that is happening, for example, in EDRI. If there is anybody from EDRI, you're doing really great job also in these terms, and especially the whole, you know, now discussion about AI and those kind of things that are creating some new sort of inequalities. This is a really good starting moment to raise different questions about digital rights. And I think DFF is also doing a really great job in starting those kind of conversation, but I think it's still not enough. It definitely changed a lot. And I've been here, you know, here, I mean, in this discussion since 2011. So I can see also how it evolved. But I think it's still something that the questions about equality is a big thing. And I remember, you know, even, you know, one of the most important slogans for digital rights, like freedom, not fear. And I think that's, you know, it's slightly different now, isn't it? Or maybe it should be, or maybe we should add something else, maybe equality and freedom, not fear and neoliberalism. I don't know.
So, you know, then I think it's very important to what extent people are aware of these systems, like their public awareness, because it of course, definitely, whenever algorithms are at work, it doesn't feel like that discriminating when a public officer is discriminating against you because of your race, gender, or ethnicity, or your disability. So what can we do to actually make this more salient, that the public awareness towards algorithms?
Well, you know, I would say when we publish, for example, the materials that we received from the Ministry of Labor, the scoring system and the questions, people, first of all, that was our webpage went down when it was published because so many people were interested in that. So it's not that people do not see those things work. They know if those things happen, especially, you know, in such things as welfare system, if their life depends on it. Of course, it's completely different element if those things are, you know, just part of the bigger decision-making systems. And here, I really don't know what to do. It's like just raising awareness as we have been doing for many years. But is it effective? I don't know. But the things when you can really connect it to their real life struggles, this is something that people are interested, are very interested. They want to know more. Also, they need resources to help them, basically. That's also, I think, now I'm thinking, your question about the whole constitutional court and political issues around that. Well, receiving information from the government, which is still possible in Poland, I guess, through FOIA requests, and giving resources to people. Well, you don't need to go to constitutional courts to help people from the ground, basically, and giving them some sort of tools that, in this, for example, case, or those type of cases can help a lot, I would say. However, it raises ethical questions of gaming the system or whatever. This is something that helps in their life struggles with the algorithmic system or semi-algorithmic system.
There is also a question with respect to the technology. So the question is, could technology or data play a positive role? For building mutual support mechanism for people?
Well, definitely, because I think, you know, from the 70s, data processing systems in the context of European welfare system, this is the core of them. So they are helping because, you know, the whole systems, they are based on data and processing data. There is no welfare system without processing information. Maybe you can think about some kind of universal basic income that everybody's at some point receiving the amount of money. But data is building welfare system, so it is already happening. Of course, we can see some new kind of AI system. And on the other hand, I haven't seen, because I'm following, of course, those developments with AI in the particular welfare administration aspect. I haven't seen such anything like very perfect example, very good thing. Maybe they are some and they are not highlighted. I would like to see that. But we need to be very aware that computer and data systems are already part of this and they are helping us a lot. that's something that I would really like to stress.
And one more question, Yedrek. I know we're talking almost 1 hour, and you must be also, you're talking very concentrated, and it is, I can imagine, also tiring. But this is a tough question, I think. What was the role of the right to social security in this litigation? So we're talking about effective remedy, about non-discrimination, about transparency, but what role, if any, did the right to social security play in legal policy and social discourse on the profile at all?
Unfortunately, I would say none. I've been trying to use the European Social Charter argument, this advocacy thing, because, for example, under the right to work, there are also provisions related to transparency of the unemployment mechanism systems, either computerized or not. Unfortunately, the status of social rights, first of all, in Polish constitution, we have the chapter about social rights. So we slightly can use it, but they are not, it's not as a strong framework as, for example, rights of privacy, unfortunately. The European Social Charter is a very weak treaty, unfortunately, as well. So it is very hard.
I didn't understand. The European Social Charter was?
It's a very weak legal instrument. Yeah. If you don't know, this is like the treaty that was introduced in the 1960s. It's basically a list of social rights in Europe. Most of the European countries sign it, but does not give a lot of, you know, space to advocate, or maybe advocate, yes, but litigate not so much. So unfortunately, on the other hand, you know, it's a difference between rights to social security, and I would say equal redistribution, because that was more in this sense, that was some sort of more political argument. And for example, it was raised by some trade unions that were trying to also advocate against this profiling mechanism. But it was not the strongest still argument. And when we were in conversation with the ombudsman, they also didn't want to use this argument. It is also very interesting because, you know, in the ombudsman office, they have the separate department for labor and social security and separate department for political and civil rights. And that was a case for civil rights, not the labor and social security. Social security, it's data protection, so it's not that space. It's a very interesting dynamic also from institutional point of view, how to approach those issues. Sorry,
Idris. In the beginning, you also made some reference to other countries. You know, I'm still not very clear with respect to the Polish security system, since I'm not from Poland and I haven't been living there. But can you like contextualize much more Poland within the European social security systems? How would you see Poland as from a social security perspective? The German and some other Western European countries are the only references, only countries I know, I'm aware of. Where would you locate the social security system of Poland within the European context?
Yeah, like I think it's, you know, also it evolved over the years. When we started and when the reform and the profiling mechanism was introduced, it was still, I would say, post-socialist social security system. However, that went through kind of neoliberal reforms during the 90s that, you know, like it was tough times, a lot of cuts, neoliberals in power. So it was not great. And 2011, just after also the crisis, however, we didn't have a huge unemployment. Unemployment was still quite huge, but, you know, the benefits are very low. Also, I was unemployed back then, and I used the job center. It is not a nice place to go. Like really, like it's a tough institution. Nobody has any kind of time. It was not a place that you wanted to be part of. Things have changed, fortunately or unfortunately, probably fortunately, especially with this nationalistic government, I would say the provisions are much more generous in this matter. So we have those kind of benefits that are also interesting from the computer side. Like they are using a lot of computer systems now also to give benefits to people. They are much higher. They are like allowance for families. I would say it's quite generous comparing to, for example, what I know in UK. It's not as bad, especially the family allowance, maternity leaves, those kind of things are really well covered. It's not perfect. It's still, element of the state that has not enough funding. So probably, and I would expect that they could use more information system to also manage, the scarcity of the resources, which is the most tempting thing to do, and to introduce and justify introducing such kind of mechanism as I was describing with this whole talk.
Idrik, I would love to continue this conversation. Unfortunately, I think the time is almost over. So I would like to express my thank you, because this was such an insightful and very thought-provoking conversation. I think I should also thank the DFF, the Digital Freedom Fund, for making this possible. And if I'm not wrong, I would like to pass the floor to Judith in order to make some final words and to say goodbye to us all. Jedrek, thank you once more for this conversation. I learned a lot. I hope also that the audience thinks the same.
Thank you so much as well.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, both of you. This was an extremely interesting webinar. Thank you so much for moderating this event, Cengiz, so splendidly. And also thank you, Jedrek, for talking us through not just the detail of the case, but also your work with the affected communities. I think it was particularly interesting to listen to, how this work has affected you personally, and, how this is a difference maybe to the way in which lawyers often find themselves working just within the strictures of the law, so to speak. Right. So please note, everyone, that this webinar has been recorded and that the recording will be made available on our website and our YouTube channel soon for those of you who want to revisit anything that was discussed today. And for those who couldn't attend, of course, today, so if you want to, tell anybody else about the fact that this has happened and that there is material out there. For the academics among you, feel free to use the video in your teaching and your research. And let me just again also respond to Cengiz and thank our speaker and our moderator profusely for being with us today. And we are going to continue this series next week with our next event, where we will be joined by Kevin Deliban and Shannon Baller to talk about automating care, challenging assessment by computer in Arkansas. There is still time to register for that event by following the link on our website. But for now, thank you, everybody, very much for participating. Thank you, the team from DFF, who have as always worked really tirelessly in the background. And thank you most of all, our audience, who has been brilliant with bringing us so many questions that have really made this event special. So thanks, everyone. And I hope that you enjoyed the discussions, and it is now safe to leave. Thank you. Bye.